once upon a time...
Begin at the beginning, I suppose.
My purpose in coming here tonight was twofold.
As you see, my dear Pick, the human ear is a perfect recording and amplifying apparatus.
Texture.
An artifact.
When do we start?
Oh, we started.
It sounds like this.
Digging out the old 78s and the Glenn Miller, which is Andrew's sister's, which is his thing.
My father was born in Leominster. He was the only one of a family that wasn't born in Hereford. In fact, one of the jokes was within the family that he was known as the foreigner by his brothers. My grandfather, my father's father, had come out of the First World War. Well, he'd been villaged out of the Navy, first of all, after the Dardanelles campaign. He was called up in 1917 and ended up on the Western Front, basically doing labouring work, Royal Naval Regiment. And it seemed to have affected his health. And even when he came back, he rejoined the family firm. He'd always been the black sheep of the family, but they allowed him back in again. And that was painting and decorating. They also ran a decorating shop, well, for materials, on East Street in Hereford. And he just had a job at one point, which was in Leominster for a while. So he was there, based there, when my father was born. My father's one of five boys. They had a sister who died, so my father was the third youngest. He had two younger brothers and two elder ones. There was Frank and Tom were older. And the younger ones were Bill and Jim. Well, Bill's the youngest, actually, though it's one of those family things that Jim, it wasn't his real name. His real name was Arthur Philip Errington, APE. It's an unfortunate one, really, with the initials.
His dad was in that business. How about his mum?
Edie Coombs, was born in Manchester, but the family had connections to both Hereford and Manchester. In fact, Uncle Jim, Arthur Philip, and that side of the family were round Manchester, South Manchester, Cheshire way, and that was their base, really. So my cousin Bill now lives in Hay and Wye, was Mancunian. My two cousins that I know, they've all got thick Manchester accents.
It was 1992 that he died, is that right? Is that the right year?
Yes.
Okay.
I had a call from my friend Steve to go to the Cheltenham Festival. So I went down and met him there. Had a good day at the races. I'm not a great betting man myself, but I actually turned a profit of about £50 that day. Came back and my mother had called up and the messages and things. And he'd been taken to hospital. He'd and had a heart attack, died shortly after he got to hospital.
Mm. Okay. He'd had heart problems before, yeah?
Yes, he'd had tablets since I can't remember when. He used to blame it, saying it was something to do with his partial gastrectomy, but from what I can gather, there isn't any link whatsoever.
Right.
But it may have been underlying conditions.
Oh.
Other things, the stress, getting double pneumonia, the effect of what have you on his body at the time.
Smoking, of course.
Yes, he was quite a heavy smoker.
Oh.
He was rather fond of Tennent's Extra Lager or Super Brew or something, I don't know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, had a couple of cans of that, fall asleep. Well, his father died when he was 10, 1931, of TB, and my grandmother was fiercely protective of her boys, and the stories I got are just ones of running slightly wild in some cases. He mentions about having sort of gang fights with cabbage stalks, which are pretty effective, they're like as clubs, believe me. And there was something about getting something with a bit of wood with a nail in ending up in his head.
In his head? Wow.
I don't think it's particularly rough, but it was just sort of knockabout. But you've got to think that they weren't well off at all. In his bedroom, tried to build a canoe to go on the Wye, and he built the canoe okay, from bits, but then he couldn't get it out of the room. He was also, right from a child, trying to get into showbiz, I suppose. There's so many cards and posters and references to him. He had a couple of strings to his bow. You probably remember that he had an accordion. But before then, he tried to be a siffleur, a whistler, putting your fingers in your mouth and blowing and getting tunes that way. I've got some photos of him as a very skinny young teenager, wearing a gaucho outfit and playing an accordion. And he formed a duo with another lad who was apparently a very good musician. And amongst other things, they did some small tours, including to Ireland, not long before the start of the war.
Ring out a song of good cheer. Now's the time to roll the barrel for the gang's all here.
Well, my mother was still working most of that time, hadn't retired, never learned to drive, so my father used to have to take her to work in the mornings, collect her afterwards. Various cars and a little caravanette thing, little Fiat that kept breaking down, and afterwards got a Bedford CF, sort of thing I remember as an ice cream van as a kid. I ended up with it after my father was told to stop driving. It was more rust than metal. It did about 15 miles to the gallon and maximum speed about 40.
I remember he smoked those little cigars.
Yes, he also smoked rollies. He used to recover the tobacco at the end of it and reuse it. Army habit, I suppose.
Of course, Auntie Lizzie lived nearby.
Not too far away. I think by then she was living in Elam, just down the road, about 4 or 5 miles.
What memories do you have from the 1990s?
I must have been difficult because, to be perfectly frank, they didn't like each other very much by then.
They didn't?
No. It wasn't open warfare or anything. It was a sort of resigned semi-tension all the time. I think simmering for a while, but there were causes.
Okay.
And going back to that thing in Lincoln, I remember, it was to do with another man and... I mean, I'm far too young to remember the details of it, but yes. And there was another incident as well afterwards, when she was working at the swimming pool. But when I'm going through the papers after she died, finding all... You know, this stuff where he went to a solicitor was asking about divorce and stuff, so it got quite serious.
Okay.
As I said, he was quite uptight and nervous and unsure of himself a lot of the time. He was... I think living with a certain degree of anger, mostly unexpressed.
I remember he was not allowed to drive at some point.
Yes, he'd been down to the local pub and had a couple of pints and managed to slightly go off the road. And he had heart condition anyway, he was on tablets and that. He wasn't prosecuted or anything, he was merely told to not drive anymore. My father's first job after leaving school was in Bulmers, the cider makers. He was in the advertising department. Wow. He was a pretty good artist, and I think they were going to make use of those particular skills. He joined the Territorial Army at the time, when he was 17. Come 1939, a month after he turned 18, he was out on manoeuvres in Weston-super-Mare, and an officer rode up on a horse and said, "I say, men, war's been declared." And suddenly he found himself in the army. But they had to do initial training, and he never actually got sent off with the BEF, which was all full-time soldiers, the ones that got evacuated from Dunkirk. So he didn't, I was going to say, have that glory, but it was hardly something to be desired.
So where was he stationed at the beginning of the war?
Well, he got moved into various units, as happened with the Territorials. I've got a lovely photo of him wearing the dress uniform of the Gordon Highlanders, which sounds a bit weird, but they went to whichever units needed extra men, really. I don't know who else he served with. He became a signaller fairly early on. He knew Morse, he taught me Morse, which I've totally forgotten. To my shame. And yes, he could tune in radios and make signals and also receive signals. There was a story that he was helping to train people at one point to pick up the signals from the Germans, the ones that were eventually decoded by certain agencies of the state, let's put it that way. But if he had done, he certainly wouldn't have said anything if he'd been involved, Station X or anything. I mean, he wouldn't have been himself actually decoding it, but he'd help them to work out the radios, tune into the broadcasts, translate the Morse code and so on. So 63 in Lincoln. At one point, my parents had absolutely blazing row, and my father accused my mother of something. I mean, she was never happy going outside Kent, living outside Kent. So whether it be Cornwall or Lincoln, she wasn't happy being there. She said it made her asthma worse. So my father resigned his job at the RSPCA, senior inspector, and we came down, back down to Kent. We ended up for a few months in Saltwood, in my grandmother's house, Glen Eagles, my mother's mother's house. My father stayed with his mother, who lived in Hyde, just down the road, a few miles. That went on for a few months until we got a place, a masonette, half a big Victorian terrace in Templar Street in Dover. House has completely been demolished since. There's a block of flats or something there instead. And we were there until moved up to a new, brand new build, a council's estate house in Kimberley Close in Dover in 66. My father's mother came across, it must have been 65, and it was just before Christmas she came to us, and she died in the January. She said she'd come over to die. Why she didn't choose any of the other relatives, I don't know.
So he got a different job at this point?
No, he did some work for the post office telephones, international exchange, telephony skills again, I suppose. And afterwards, he got a job as a custodian at Dover Castle. Richard Baker, who has a name to conjure with on the television, interviewed someone, and because he was happened to be around and the man in charge didn't fancy doing it, he ended up interviewing my father, sort of post 6 o'clock news programme. He did apply to be actually run Walber Castle as such, which was another site up the road, which was the home of the Lord Warden of the Cinque-Port, Sir Henry VIII period fort, the Walmerney deal. And I didn't get that job, but I do remember applying for it. And afterwards he got a job as, well, the job as the town sergeant and mayor's officer for the mayor of Dover, which is where you've seen that fancy uniform when he was the mace bearer. So he'd walk along in the processions holding the mace. He was in charge of the running of the town hall, the Maison Dieu Hall in Dover, which is an old medieval hospital rebuilt in Victorian times. There were visits, kind of like diplomatic things between twin towns and different parts of the local area coming together for celebrations and so on, and occasional events marking so many years since VE Day or something, and Mayor and Corporation would go out and he'd be there, or there'd be visits by people and he'd be expected to be there in the evening. So I remember a couple of dinners he went to and came back with a half bottle of wine and so not that I got any of the wine.
Wow.
And
sure.
Princess Anne visiting at one point and this, that and the other. So yes, so I got a pair of compasses and a map of England and drew a little line 250 miles from Dover and wouldn't apply to anything within that circle. When I came back the first summer holiday after I went to Liverpool, they moved. There was a reorganisation in local government and effectively Dover Corporation ceased to exist. It became part of Canterbury. And my father changed jobs and became mayor's officer to the mayor of Canterbury. And there was a little house. It was actually two old gasboard cottages fitted together, so it had two staircases and this, that and the other. It was right next to the ruin of the Norman Keep in Canterbury. And but actually, I didn't know where they were exactly. I had the address, but I didn't have a vision. I only vaguely knew Canterbury, the high street where the cathedral was and so on. So when I arrived, I thought, I've got to get to Canterbury. Which station is it I go to? Because there's two train stations in Canterbury, Canterbury East and Canterbury West. And luckily, this is the only time in my life I've ever sent a telegram. I'm arriving at Canterbury West at so-and-so. Could you pick me up, please? Which is okay, because it was 200 yards from the house. So he was also supposed to drive the mayor of Canterbury around.
Right.
And he was a dreadful driver, actually. But that's not the point. He had a heart complaint. And shortly after taking the job, maybe 6 months, a year afterwards, he was effectively forced to retire on medical grounds. Then, because that came with a job effectively, had to get a transfer and ended up in a house in Barham, Barham, yep, in Kent, just down the road from Canterbury. And that was an ex-miner's cottage. Not many people remember now. There was a coal field in Kent. Barham was one of the villages whereby some of the mining houses were. It wasn't near, particularly near the pit.
I think when he retired, he started taking up painting again, didn't he? I remember he did some
painting. Yes, he did. He got several of his canvases. They're pretty good, actually. He was a pretty talented amateur artist.
Because I remember going to stay in their house in Barham. It's an interesting little village, the way the river occasionally appears.
Yes, if it's a wet winter, the chalk fills up with water and the springs come out, you end up with a fairly swift-running stream, a winterbourne.
I remember Grandad telling stories. It was a story about a sausage.
Yes, jumped out of the pan.
Jumped out of the pan.
Used to tell one about a little cloud, a few other ones as well. But he told these stories. He was actually quite a good storyteller in his own way.
I remember all the birds. They went and fed the birds every morning, and there were loads of different birds, and they knew all the birds, and they had names for them.
Yes, see, it was a one-eyed crow that my father was quite fond of. He used to come every morning for some food, called Charlie.
Okay, and Ebenezer the seagull, I remember. Well.
I don't remember that one, but no. Yes.
That was it was a small house. It was I was a small child, so it seemed bigger, but it was a pretty tiny.
It was tiny. It was a one decent sized bedroom, a box room. You could just about get a single bed in, and kitchen, living room. They added a little glass thingy at the back, which extended a bit, so some sitting area. But to get all of us in there was a real difficult thing to do. I'm trying to work out when he actually met my mother, because my mother went out to Cornwall, somewhere near Mousel, once the worst of the hostilities occurred, because right way around the southeast of Kent, it was pretty bad. You don't just get bombed. In Dover in particular, you could have shells exploding from big German guns in Calais. And it was so bad that you had to have something called war insurance, a bit like house insurance. And people were actually selling houses or paying them to be taken off their hands so they didn't have to pay this war insurance. Because my mother, though she went with the family to Mousel, came back. She was complaining that it made her asthma worse. So they went back into the complete hell going on round, higher than her case, in Kent, before. But remember, she had all these stepsisters and stepbrothers or whatever, and a half-sister. And they were all effectively dancing to her tune. They would have stayed in a corn for the duration otherwise. But as it is, they moved back. So sometime around 43, maybe 44, my parents met. I mean, I had stories from her. She was saying about being on a date with a pilot, and she asked him to go and get her some flowers from a field, and he didn't want to get his uniform muddy, so she ended it with him. But certainly, sweethearts for her forces, and he was off then. I don't think he actually came back till the beginning of 46, but I'm not sure about that. He came back to Hereford for a time, then he went back and, was it 47, 48? That's my parents were married, 48 I think. And from then on he was in Saltwood, Kent. Now, I know a few jobs he had. He did some work as a postman. At the time I was born, he was working on a local farm that was actually producing duck eggs, which sounds a bit weird. He was a duck farmer, and they produced these duck eggs, which are apparently ideal for making the cakes for Lion's Cakes, which were a big thing. The farm manager was a man called Alex Plovery, who's my godfather. He was a very keen stamp collector, so every now and again I get a few stamps coming through. But I don't remember visiting him more than a couple of times, so for some reason he decided to become an RSPCA inspector and applied for that. It was in uniform, you see. Also, being a married man with two children, he had to have a job that was fairly secure. Mind you, the house came with the job, and also the car, well, a van, in fact, as it was a van. In those days, most people didn't have cars. Really socially up the scale there, We had a telephone as well. I cannot say how much that was important at the time, because as a business one, we weren't allowed to have other people come in to make their own phone calls. I remember him making a phone call to his brother in Manchester, and this was a long distance call. They had to go through different exchanges. The first house was, there's a little block of three cottages called Beckett's Terrace, which is in Castle Road in Saltwood, near Hythe, Kent. It's right opposite Saltwood Castle. Well, I was about 18 months old when they moved to Dover, when he took over being the RSPCA inspector for Dover and District. It was an end of terrace, but a quite large one, Elmsville Road, 122A, I think. But it had a garage behind in the plot, and it seemed to have a very large garden to me as a small child. Well, he was an RSPCA inspector for 7 years, and perhaps more than 8 years, because when I was eight, he had a transfer to Lincoln.
You all moved up there and moved schools? Is that right?
Absolutely everything, yes.
How long was that for?
20 months odd. It was less than 2 years.
Did he listen to a lot of music? Was he interested in music at all? I think of him as a musician, but I didn't hear him talking about music a lot. What were his opinions about music at that time?
Not really. He used to people like the Andrews Sisters and the Ink Spots, and, well, the big band music of the day. Like Glenn Miller, for example.
Right.
It's very much his sort of music. But for some reason, he didn't actually play music very much at home. I mean, not in terms of having a gramophone or listening to music on the radio much.
We visited around 1989. There was a reggae orchestra did a version of Minnie the Moocher, and he wasn't impressed.
I'm not surprised.
So that sounds kind of like American taste rather than the British version.
I think so, yes. He's probably found it a bit polite, some of the British stuff coming out.
Who do you have in Britain? Like Gracie Fields and George Formby. Yeah. And Vera Lynn. Oh, I remember.
Yes.
I remember he didn't like Vera Lynn. I remember him saying he didn't like Vera Lynn, that he couldn't stand her. Which I thought was very...
The Force's sweetheart, but not for him. Just a matter of taste, really. He preferred to swing it a bit more.
Did he still go out to play music at all?
Well, yes, I do remember him, as I say, going to a holiday camp at the Camber Sands with my uncle Bill, who played drums, who lived in Hythe, so it wasn't that far away. I mean, he liked some people that... Hot Club de France. He was really keen on Stephen Grappelli. Going away from music, but beyond the sort of issue, he quite liked the Goons, but my mother hated it. Possibly a sort of army humour that came from the Goon members who shared that sort of humour.
Getting into the 60s now.
I do have a tale about being in Lincoln. My sister, obviously, when she'd been, I was 9, so she'd have been 12, wanted to see the Beatles. They were on one of these package tours, so there'd been Roy Orbison and these Bachelors and four or five other acts, and she was upset, really upset, because my dad wouldn't allow her to go and watch them.
As far as being the RSPCA inspector, that did...
Senior inspector, then.
Senior inspector, okay.
Yes, he got promoted.
Did that involve being a vet?
No. It's, well, if there was anything sort of... In terms of that, you take them to a vet, the animals to the vet.
Okay.
He'd, even when Dover, he'd actually got a medal from the RSPCA, which I can go and lay my hands on now, for rescuing two dogs from a well. But I remember other things as well. For example, going to some farms and looking at the animal welfare, and when the visiting circuses came, because they had animals at the time, which they don't these days, looking around then. So, yes, that was quite interesting, seeing a few exotic animals.
Where was the seal? Was that later on, or was that...?
That was in Dover, before we moved up to Lincoln. St Margaret's Bay, yes. It was a seal pup, and it was brought over to us, and, well, what do you do with a seal? It was in the bath for a couple of days. I was already at school, so all the school pals had to come round to look at this seal pup in the bath. It was very cute. It got silly because we ended up with a few budgies that people found and brought to us, and so put them in a cage, and got another cage, and another cage, and they started breeding. We ended up with 23 of the things. I don't remember us ever having cats, but we did have a succession of dogs. The first dog they had that I don't remember is one called Dinah, who was a Springer Spaniel. Then a little poodle called Pepe. Also remember getting an Alsatian called Jet, because he was almost entirely black. This dog was a sandwich short of a picnic, really, but it was very loyal, but only to my father. My father, me and my father, tried to organise these things, so got a bottle of aniseed oil and put it on the soles of the shoes, myself and my sister, and set us running up the North Downs, the hills just outside, and then coming to do a trail to find us with the dog. I think he was in, before D-Day, sent to Hampshire somewhere, or around Portsmouth, somewhere around there.
But did he not talk about those placings so much?
Well, yes, there was one story that we didn't make too much of. It doesn't reflect on him particularly well. He always played in bands. I remember him playing in holiday camps, and he played the double bass, and his brother Bill played drums. But going back to his army days, he was always involved in the dance bands at the time, playing the double bass. So it was quite in demand. And before D-Day, the weather was pretty terrible. No one thought there was anything going to happen for several days. And he went off one evening with permission to play in a dance band. And he came back in the early hours of the morning to camp, and there was no one there. Everyone had gone off for D-Day. His rifle had gone. Everything had gone. Which is why he ended up going in on D-Day plus one. And I don't know if he presumably joined up with his unit again. And again, I don't know much of what happened about the fighting across northern France. There are a couple of little incidents he reports. So he was there in the back of the truck with his headphones on, and the sort of curtain things at the back of the truck opened, and there was a 6'4" German standing there with a 5'3" Tommy behind him with a rifle in his back. But the first thing he saw, obviously, was a 6'4" German. He expressed a certain amount of surprise and fear over this. And I was talking to some of his friends when they met up on one or two occasions. I can remember stories about a pig going missing. Well, one of them had a certain knowledge of butchery, so I think they ate quite well that night. Meeting up with Polish units, and they were all professional piano players and university lecturers and things. I can't really go through all of it, but I do know that when he got through to Belgium, he was billeted on the La de David family in Tournai, the French-speaking part of Belgium, and became friends with Camille, their son. There's photographs of him and Camille, and there was a sort of friendship. I remember Monsieur, Madame La de David coming over to our place in Elmsville Road in Dover when I must have been about six. I went over when I was 13 and stayed for a week in Belgium, went over on my own. But anyway, from Tournai, he went on afterwards. I can't really tell you much about anything. He never really spoke about it. He did at one point get rather ill trying to ford a stream, and he got pneumonia, double pneumonia, and was ill for a while. And whatever else happened, though, he seemed to have suffered a certain amount of PTSD. Mm. Obviously not really recognised at the time. He wasn't full-on shell shock, but he ended up with being a constant worrier. He had a partial gastrectomy after a gastric ulcer, and he found it very difficult afterwards to settle down to jobs that weren't outside and ones that weren't in uniform.